WUSB 90.1 FM, Stony Brook. You're listening to The Healthy Planet, and we'll be back in 30 seconds.
We all agree that we're equal as people, then why can't we see what is evil? I can't breathe. You're taking my life from me. I can't breathe. Will anyone fight for me?
Welcome to this edition of The Healthy Planet radio program. My name is Bob DiBenedetto, your host for the best hour of your life. That's right, the one that's always in front of you, right now. The Healthy Planet focuses on topics that will help to educate you about the deep connection among all life on Earth and the powerful effects your everyday choices can have on creating a clean, healthy, and compassionate world. Now, if our listeners here are like me, this past year has been, among other things, a year of learning. Scholars and others have long been speaking about racism that was rooted deep in our society for centuries. And while I was really quite aware of the truth of racism for many decades, that awareness really ramped up in the past 5 or 6 years. And then last year's massive, historic, nationwide protest by millions were deeply inspiring to me and so many others. Now, the situation that led to the need for the protests was tragic. But the rising up of that unified voice by so many people in the streets was needed because the problem of racism has been festering for a long, long time. And the pain caused by racism has been building up for a long, long time. And of course, that which is under the surface is going to manifest someday. And the protests were that manifestation of all that that was built up. With all that said, while I was aware and inspired, I hadn't put in the time to research the topic in as deep a way as I could have. You know, with all of us, there are so many hours in the day, and my focus in particular has been on health and environmental education. And the volume of information that's out there on the topics that we cover on a regular basis and need to stay abreast of in our nonprofit work is enormous and a challenge in and of itself. I'm sure you can relate. But the events of last year changed that. I saw that it was now time for us to put on our students' hats and dig down into what was fueling the protests that were going on and the underlying situation that caused the protests. So we did cover this on shows in the past. We did a whole show on the topic of systemic racism last year. And of course, I've been thinking and reading a lot about the topic over the months, as many of you have. But something very recently kind of blew me away when I realized it. And it's basic to those of you who have put a lot of thought into this topic. But for me, it was a revelation. And sometimes it's nice to have a revelation. We think we know everything and then boom. And that's the beauty of being alive and being able to learn, is that you can find out the things that you didn't know that you didn't know. And then that can change your perspective. Anyway, what I found out was how incredibly connected the topic of systemic racism is to so many of our environmental issues. Now, I knew about the connection for decades, but it didn't strike me how dependence destruction of our environment was on the existence of this systemic and environmental racism. And I'd like to explain a bit about that, starting by talking about environmental justice. That's a term that's thrown around a lot these days, and it's not often explained. So environmental justice is when everybody enjoys the same degree of protection from environmental and health hazards, and when all have equal access to the decision-making process to have a healthy environment in which to live. So it's basic fairness in dealing with protecting all communities from environmental and health hazards, and it's where everybody has a say in how environmental and health hazards are treated. So if there were environmental justice, all those hazardous industries, power plants, factory farms, landfills, refineries, and others would be equally distributed in rich and poor and black and brown and white communities. And all communities would be at the table deciding about these health environmental issues. But that's not how it works now. Here's how it does work. When the politicians at the top decide whether they want the coal power or the wind power, they're not thinking, what's best for my family? If I back coal mining and burning, it'll happen in the neighborhood where I, my husband, wife, or kids live. My kids will be at higher risk of everything from heart disease to respiratory diseases, cancer, asthma, and everything else. And if they site this coal-burning power plant by our home, we don't have the resources to pick up and move to another area, so I'd better not vote for that. Yep, politicians aren't thinking that way. And you know why? because for the most part, they don't live in the neighborhoods that are impacted by the industries that pollute the most and cause enormous health problems in the communities where they're sited. Period. So for those who make decisions on whether to support a healthy environment or the polluting industries who give them large campaign contributions, it's like a board game. There are no real-world consequences to making a decision that's anti-health and anti-environment. They can accept that nice campaign donation from the oil industry, speak on behalf of actions that'll promote that polluting energy, and know that they will likely, never ever, have to suffer from the worst consequences. Because it is likely that it is never ever going to be placed in their communities. And if it was, they would have the means to move. It's kind of like the saying that if the leaders had to fight the wars they started, there would be way fewer wars. In this case, if the politicians and their families had to live with the pollution they stand behind, there would be much less dangerous pollution. And that's pretty certain. And that's where racism comes in. Dr. Robert Bullard, known as the founder of the environmental justice movement, has talked about studies that ask the question of what are the best predictors of where hazardous waste facilities get sited. Now, you might think they get sited more often in places with low income, property values, might be related to land values, or maybe education, right? But actually, the most potent predictor, he says, of where these dangerous facilities were placed is race. And you can guess which races are most often the victims. Look, we don't have slavery anymore, all right? One thing down. And we don't have Jim Crow laws anymore, another thing down. But the majority of our nation's history is built upon white people using and profiting from people of color without allowing them to have a voice in the matter. That's not a judgment. That's not a partisan statement. And even though you don't like it, it's our history. Now, I'd like to double back and talk about Jim Crow a little bit. Another term that's thrown around a lot, but not often explained. And since this is so important to understanding the history of racism in America, I'm going to read a description from the Constitutional Rights Foundation, explaining what Jim Crow is. And I quote, "Jim Crow was a derisive slang term for a black man. It came to mean any state law passed in the South that established different rules for blacks and whites. Jim Crow laws were based on the theory of white supremacy and were a reaction to Reconstruction. In the Depression-racked 1890s, racism appealed to whites who feared losing their jobs to blacks. Politicians abused blacks to win the votes of poor white crackers," in quotes. "Newspapers fed the bias of white readers by playing up, and sometimes even making up, black crimes." Sound familiar? In 1890, in spite of its 16 black members, the Louisiana General Assembly passed a law to prevent black and white people from riding together on railroads. Plessy versus Ferguson, a case challenging the law, reached the U.S. Supreme Court in 1896. Upholding the law, the court said that public facilities for blacks and whites could be, in quote, "separate but equal." Soon, throughout the South, they had to be separate. 2 years later, the court seemed to seal the fate of black Americans when it upheld a Mississippi law designed to deny black men the vote. Given the green light, Southern states began to limit the voting rights to those who owned property or could read well, to those whose grandfathers had been able to vote, to those with, quote, "good characters," unquote, to those who paid poll taxes. In 1896, Louisiana had 130,334 registered black voters. 8 years later, only 1,342, 1%, could pass the state's new rules. Jim Crow laws touched every part of life. In South Carolina, black and white textile workers could not work in the same room, enter through the same door, or gaze out of the same window. Many industries wouldn't hire blacks. Many unions passed rules to exclude them. In Richmond, one could not live on a street unless most of the residents were people one could marry. One could not marry someone of a different race. By 1914, Texas had 6 entire towns in which blacks could not live. Mobile passed a Jim Crow curfew. Blacks could not leave their homes after 10 p.m. Signs marked "whites only" or "colored" hung over doors, ticket counters, and drinking fountains. Georgia had black and white parks. Oklahoma had black and white phone booths. Prisons, hospitals, and orphanages were segregated, as were schools and colleges. In North Carolina, black and white students had to use separate sets of textbooks. In Florida, the books couldn't even be stored together. Atlanta courts kept two Bibles, one for black witnesses and one for whites. Virginia told fraternal social groups that black and white members could not address each other as brother. Though seemingly rigid and complete, Jim Crow laws did not account for all of the discrimination that blacks suffered. Unwritten rules barred blacks from white jobs in New York and kept them out of white stores in Los Angeles. Humiliation was about the best treatment blacks who broke such rules could hope for. Groups like the Ku Klux Klan, which revived in 1915, used venom and violence to keep blacks, quote, in their place. More than 360,000 black men served in World War I. The country welcomes them home with 25 major race riots, the most serious in Chicago. White mobs lynched veterans in uniform. Black Americans fought back. The National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, founded in 1909, and the Urban League publicized abuses and worked for redress. Though they drew support from both races, these groups barely stemmed the tide. The 1920s and 1930s produced new Jim Crow laws. By 1944, a Swede visiting the South pronounced segregation so complete that whites did not see blacks except when being served by them. And in 1964, President Lyndon B. Johnson signs the Civil Rights Act, which legally ended the segregation that had been instituted by Jim Crow laws. And in 1965, the Voting Rights Act halted efforts to keep minorities from voting. The Fair Housing Act of 1968, which ended discrimination in renting and selling homes, followed. So Jim Crow laws were technically off the books after 1968. Though that has not always guaranteed full integration or adherence to anti-racism laws throughout the United States. It's really important to understand that the majority of our nation's history is built upon white people using and profiting from people of color without allowing them to have a voice in the matter. That's not a judgment, that's not a partisan statement, it's our history. Citing polluting industries in our recent history in neighborhoods of color has been the path of least resistance, since along with the disadvantage of their race, they have the disadvantage of not having power, and so not being in a position to make the big decisions. So with the vacuum of power, those in power decide, consciously or not, to put all the dangerous crap in neighborhoods that don't have the power to fight back. That's environmental injustice. The pollution we've lived with in this country could just be looked at as a necessary evil. And some of it is, since in order to live the lives we've become accustomed to, you have to manufacture stuff and fuel and all kinds of other toxic chemicals. What is not a necessary evil, however, is burdening certain underprivileged communities with a disproportionate amount of exposure and a disproportionate amount of risk. And what's also unnecessary is voting in favor of dirty energy and technologies when clean alternatives are now available. And that's still happening to this day. Just today, I read an article entitled "Republicans Pledge Allegiance to Fossil Fuels Like It's Still the 1950s. The article went on to say that Republican-led states are threatening retaliation against banks that refuse to lend to coal, oil, and gas companies. They're looking to delay the transition to clean energy. They're looking to delay the transition to energy that's actually going to create a lot of jobs, save lives, and put the United States into a leadership position in the world. So some of our elected officials are voting for unnecessary pollution in the form of oil, coal, and gas when we simply don't need it, in part because they won't bear the majority of the risk from that pollution. And that short explanation and description brings me to the talk I'm going to play for you now. You might believe that everything I've said could be fantasy, and you might think that we don't have a racist past. I don't blame you for thinking that, Why would you think otherwise, since it's not like we get history lessons on TV on a regular basis? But today, we're going to get a lesson in history that will likely test some of your assumptions about American history. And our point here is not to make everybody feel guilty or bad about our past. The past is the past. But if you don't accept that the same racism that has been outwardly condoned in our country and written into law until 50 short years ago, if you don't accept that it's still there, under the surface, then you're missing something that's going to skew how you perceive reality in the year 2020. The talk we're about to hear is by a Dr. Joe Fagan, an expert on the topic of systemic racism and gender prejudice and discriminatory behavior. And I do mean an expert. His body of work includes over 200 articles and 70 books written. He is the Ella C. McFadden Distinguished Professor at Texas A&M University. Born in San Angelo, Texas in 1938, he earned a PhD in sociology from Harvard University. He's been around for a long time. His most notable work, Ghetto Revolts, The Politics of Violence in American Cities, was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. He was named a Distinguished Professor for Sociologists Without Borders in 2005, the W.E.B. Du Bois Career of Distinguished Scholarship Award in 2013, and a Texas NAACP Civil Rights Hero Award. He sits on the editorial board for Comparative Urban and Community Research, Sage Racial and Ethnic Relations Series, and Race and Society. He continues to make significant contributions to our understanding of sex and gender inequality, the systemic nature of prejudice and discrimination, and racial-ethnic relations. His analysis of the achievements of oppressed groups accomplished in the face of systemic disenfranchisement and resistance have yielded critical insights into the characteristics and causes of oppression. So, my fellow students, take your seats and let's see if there's something you can learn about our history that will help you become a living part of the solutions going forward. Here's Dr. Joe Fagan speaking at a 2020 Mental Health America webinar, speaking on the history of systemic racism in the U.S.
Well, thank you very much for the introduction. Okay, let me start then. The first place to start in understanding America's systemic racism is to understand fully the timeline. And on that handout at the top of it, I have a timeline running from 1607, when the English colonists set up Jamestown, Virginia. And then 12 years later in 1619, they bought 20 African-American workers off a Dutch flagged ship. At the other end of that timeline is the present day, 2020. So that's about 401 years that we've had extreme racial oppression in this country. If you look at the timeline from 1619, when the first black workers were imported, until slavery ended in the 13th Amendment in 1865, that's 246 years, or about 60% of U.S. history. We are the only advanced industrialized nation that is built on slavery. Slavery is 60% of our history. After a brief reconstruction period there on the timeline, from 1865 to 1877, the white slaveholders came back into power in the South. They were no longer slaveholders. Now they run a system called Jim Crow segregation. And Jim Crow segregation lasted until 1969. There are millions of African Americans alive today who grew up under the semi-slavery, the near slavery of Jim Crow. And we've only been an officially free country from 1969 to 2020, at least from the point of view of Americans of color. And the paragraph under the timeline lays out that argument. White-on-black oppression has been embedded in our economic, political, educational, and other institutions, first during slavery and Jim Crow, and now under extensive present-day discrimination. We still live under a constitution substantially made by slaveholders. And if you add into the timeline where I'm emphasizing African-American oppression, the genocidal oppression of Native Americans from the 1600s, by the 1830s, 1850s, oppression of Mexican-Americans and Chinese-Americans, and then many other groups of color are oppressed along that timeline as you move to the present day. Anyone who's serious about anti-racist activism becoming an anti-racist has to know this racialized history. We are a country that's founded on racial oppression, and that's why it's systemic through all our major institutions. The next paragraph, number 3, I give a little more detail about systemic racism. In the U.S. case, systemic racism involves the deep structures and the surface structures of racial oppression. It includes the complex array of white anti-other practices, like anti-Black discrimination, the unjustly gained economic and political power of whites, the continuing economic and other resource inequalities along racial lines, the unjust enrichment of whites and unjust impoverishment of Blacks and other folks of color, and the racial framing created by whites to rationalize white privilege and power. So if you look at that timeline again, that's about 20 generations of Americans. For the first 18 of those generations, we whites were able to unjustly enrich ourselves on the basis of stolen land from Native Americans, stolen labor from African Americans, and stolen labor from other Americans of color. So we were unjustly enriched over the first 18 generations of this country's history at the expense, largely, of people of color. African Americans, Native Americans, and later other Americans of color were unjustly impoverished over these 18 generations again and again and again. And it's not until 1969 on that timeline that the Third Civil Rights Act goes into effect, which makes that widespread white discrimination technically illegal. Now, of course, since 1969, those civil rights acts have often not been enforced, but you can see for 350 years on that timeline, we had an extreme system of oppression that becomes systemic and it's foundational. Now, in the next paragraph, I talk about the dominant white racial frame. The dominant white created racial frame provides us whites an overarching worldview extending across all white groups. Since the 1600s, this powerful white racial frame has provided the white-generated vantage point from which whites and others have regularly viewed this society. It's way more than prejudice. It includes these important dimensions: racial stereotypes and prejudices, but it also includes racial narratives and interpretations. It includes racist images and language accents that are privileged. It includes racialized emotions, such as anger and resentment and fear among whites. And it includes inclinations to discriminatory action. Now, this dominant white frame, which has been with us since the early 1600s, includes a very positive orientation to whites as virtuous and a negative orientation to the oppressed racial others who are viewed as unvirtuous. For most whites, this dominant racial frame is a worldview that routinely provides perspectives on everyday life. Additionally, all Americans of all racial backgrounds are indoctrinated to some extent in this dominant white racial frame. So this frame has two key dimensions. It has a strong white center, pro-white. We whites are the most virtuous. We're superior in most every way. Superior in intelligence and work ethic and history and democracy, you name it. We claim to be superior in this area. And that white frame has several anti-others subframes. An anti-Black subframe that looks negatively at Black folks. An anti-Latino subframe, which looks negatively at Latinos. An anti-Asian subframe, and so forth. But the white center of the white frame is the hardest for us whites to see. Okay, let me turn to some history. In thinking about doing anti-racist work, both for ourselves as individuals and as groups working on the structures of racism in this country, the first step, I argue, is to become much better informed about our systemically racist history. It's very good to see anti-racist books, some dealing with our racist history, on the bestseller list, probably for the first time in American history right now. And let me give you two parts of history you may not know about which illustrate the great importance of becoming better informed as the first step to becoming accomplices or allies of people of color in deconstructing our racist system. We whites, and indeed everybody else, we all need to become much better informed on our racist history. Let me take one dramatic example that most of you probably haven't heard about. Francis Scott Key, I assume you know, he wrote the national anthem, the Star Spangled Banner. But what most people don't know was he was a major wealthy slaveholder and back to Africa colonizationist. That means he thought if black folks were ever freed from slavery, including those he owned, they should be shipped back to Africa. He wrote our national anthem, the Star Spangled Banner, during the U.S. War of 1812 with the British. He wrote in general terms there, as we all know, about the land of the free. Yet he did not mean what he said. If you read his writings, he viewed the nation as a slaveholding republic of free white men. That's what he wanted it to be, and that's what he fought for it to be. Significantly, in the anthem's seldom sung third verse, he wishes death upon formerly enslaved African Americans who had been promised by the British if they fled to British lines, they would be free, and some of them were fighting courageously with the British for real liberty. So in that third stanza, Key wishes them dead. Black Americans who had gone over to British lines because the British had promised them freedom. Now, from the viewpoint of enslaved African Americans, obviously, the British were defenders of real freedom, and thousands of them migrated to freedom in the British lines. So, thinking about our history or teaching our history, we can ask, why do we often sing a morally corrupted slaveholder's song so unreflectively? How can democracy be founded on a large-scale enslavement and a U.S. Constitution made by similar slaveholders to Francis Scott Key? And what does this say about our systemic racism and its white racial frame? Now, of course, we've had controversy in recent years over some black athletes allegedly said to be protesting the anthem or the flag, when in fact they're protesting police brutality. But an argument might be made that we should protest the national anthem, or at least the man who wrote it, and maybe come up with an anthem written by a democratic, democracy-loving, real democracy-loving American. One good thing about the present day is we're questioning our founders, but we need to do more than pull down statues and replace them with democracy, real democracy-loving Americans. We need to think about some of these things like our national anthem that was written by a wealthy slaveholder. He also didn't believe in the First Amendment. He tried to prosecute white men in Washington, D.C. who were passing out pamphlets against slavery. He didn't believe in their free speech and tried to prosecute them. I think we could come up with a better song. That's my personal opinion. Now, on the other side of the coin, another part of our history that's forgotten and that we need to recover are those black folks and other people of color who have fought back against our systemic racism now over more than four centuries. Let me tell you another forgotten story. About 210,000 African Americans served in the Union Army and Navy during the Civil War, and another 200,000 to 300,000 served in civilian roles supportive of military efforts. Most had been enslaved in 1861, but were now fighting in the Civil War for their permanent liberty. During the first years of that war, the sentiments of most whites, including Abraham Lincoln, were that the Union had to be restored and abolition of slavery was not a principal goal. After the general order in 1863 finally came down to recruit black soldiers, with the help of black abolitionist Frederick Douglass and white abolitionist George Stearns, large numbers of African Americans were recruited, and these courageous black soldiers and sailors provided the military strength needed at a time of serious manpower shortage. Tens of thousands of enslaved or formerly enslaved men and women also spied for Union forces, destroyed Confederate facilities, or fled plantations to the north. They obviously were counterframing against the white racial frame and slavery. They wanted out of that. And the withdrawal of essential African-American labor played a major role in the demise of the Confederacy. Without their abandonment of the Southern economy and large-scale military service, the Union cause would likely not have seen victory. The U.S. would have obviously had a dramatically different subsequent history. People often ask, who freed the slaves? Well, Lincoln usually gets credit, right? But officially, it looks like the slaves freed the slaves. Those about, 400,000 to 500,000 African Americans who played key roles in the Civil War. Their heroic efforts and many sacrifices have led us to the liberating 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments to the Constitutions. Sadly, for these African Americans and the U.S., they never got the promised 40 acres and a mule, but were essentially re-enslaved under Jim Crow's long years. And again, some questions you can ponder are, why have they been forgotten? Why did they not get freedom, real freedom? What does understanding this history mean for our working on racism and reparations issues today? And again, what does it say about our systemic racism and its white racial frame? So there's much history that needs to be recovered. There's the history of the founders like Key that we have suppressed. And there's history of Black Americans and other Americans of color who fought back for real freedom and justice. And we rarely tell that story to our children in schools or our students in colleges or in the public media. And my point about these brave African Americans who died fighting in the Civil War, where are the statues to them? People ask, what do we replace the statues with? How about some of these men and women? They actually freed the whole country from the totalitarianism of slavery.
This is Bob DiBenedetto on the Healthy Planet radio program on WUSP 90.1 FM Stony Brook. You're listening to Dr. Joe Fagan on the history of racism in America.
Now, in the last section of this handout, I talk about the present day. The first paragraph talks about the severe inequalities in workplaces, severe racial inequalities in our private sector workplaces. And since we have limited time today, I'll let you read that. Let me make the points A and B on the handout in that section. These are two examples of relatively recent social science research on how systemic racism works today as well as in the past. Because unnoted past discrimination becomes present racial inequality. What do I mean by that? Those 20 generations on the timeline, the first 18 of those 20 generations, we whites were able to generate income, wealth, success for our families, and we passed it on from one generation to the next, to the next, to the next, up to the present day. If we whites had been Black, we could not have done that. And Black Americans have been in this country for about as long as whites, but over those first 18 generations, very few could pass along enrichment to their descendants. Now, recent research by sociologist Jenny Mueller down here in the Southwest found huge racial differences in acquisition and intergenerational transfer of wealth and social capital over three plus generations of white families versus three plus generations of families of color. And I've got a quote from her doctoral dissertation here. She found that white families reported more than six times as many transfers of monetary assets across the generations in these families' histories than families of color. Six times. Majority of white families secured significant assets in the past from what I call white affirmative action programs. Large-scale federal programs like the Homestead Acts and housing and veterans programs after World War II. Her study also found white family histories have five more times as many instances of these government-derived affirmative action assets as families of color. Great inequalities persist today, usually by intent, because most whites oppose real systemic change and insist on keeping the unjust enrichments they or their ancestors have secured over four centuries of systemic racism. Thought questions, of course, how do we best account for and repair fully current white, black, and other racial inequalities today? The second section here, B, I describe another major sociological study by sociologist Nancy DiTommaso. She conducted hundreds of white interviews today, and she's demonstrated from those interviews how white networking patterns reproduce systemic racial inequality. Most of, I think, are about 200 whites. Most of the 200 whites gave her their labor and work histories. And she looked at those work histories, and most of the work histories of the white she interviewed report using acquaintances, friends, family to find most of the jobs over their lifetimes. This challenges the colored line view of many people that jobs are secured mainly because of personal qualifications and merit. Most of the whites in her study have avoided real market competition, securing jobs using their racially segregated family and friend networks. Most of the times, not one respondent out of the 200 expressed any concern about this white opportunity hoarding. Most whites fear effective affirmative actions programs will weaken or end these patterns of institutionalized favoritism for whites. It's not just discrimination against people of color that's the problem. It's this institutionalized favoritism for whites. And her respondents admitted that's how they got their jobs over their lifetime. In the last section, you can read this in more detail, but here I talk about strategies for getting rid of individual and systemic racism. The good news is that racism is man-made, human-made, and can thus be unmade. And in this last paragraph or two, I suggest three strategies you can use in workplaces and other places to deal with racist events. You can call out racist events in various ways. Somebody tells a racist joke, you can say, well, I know you meant well, but that comment hurts. You can use pointed humor. Your friend Rob tells a racist joke, say, Rob, did you learn that joke from the Klan? You can show puzzlement. There are various levels of intervention that you can use when you're around or involved in a racist event and you want to counter what the racist person is doing. Various strategies, but assertively call it out. In fact, many of these cases of racist performances are only in white backstages where whites only are present. A second strategy is to reframe the event to accent positive framing, where people have conflicting frames in their minds, highlight in their minds the justice and fairness frame. Almost all of us who are white know the liberty and justice frame. We talk, we pledge allegiance with liberty and justice for all. Now, we don't often live it. It's often, too often, a rhetorical frame. But if somebody you know engages in a racist commentary, you can say, well, what about the justice and liberty for all? That is an important set of values in this country. Try to activate a justice or fairness frame against their white racist frame. And a third strategy is remind people of their faith or moral values, if that's relevant. Almost all religions have religious values along the lines of we are all God's children or love thy neighbor as thyself. We can use those values to remind people who are doing racist performances that they're contradicting the fundamental values of the religions they often hold to. We need to regularly call out racist performances in the backstage and front stage. And the last little paragraph, obviously, we need also multiracial organizations calling out racism and teaching how to eradicate and respond to everyday racism. We need many more Stereotyping 101 and Racism 101 courses in the media and from kindergarten to graduate school. We need to teach about reparations for people of color and how that might be implemented. Thank you. Now let me take questions if you have some.
We got a question about what people of color should do when they're being told that they're too sensitive after being put down because they can't change the whole system on their own.
Yeah, that's always a tough situation. It depends on who else is present for that. If there are other people of color, it is easier to protest that kind of stereotype, right? That's a standard stereotype in the white racial framing of people of color, that they're too sensitive. And it's really a white racist reaction to people of color protesting.
Another question that we got was for people who are white, but their family hasn't been here since after slavery was outlawed, what role they have and kind of how they can help rectify this, given that it's not as simple as just giving reparations when you were not a slave-owning family at any point in time?
Yes, that's a good question, because many white Americans, like I'm Irish, the Irish came over in the 1830s and 1840s. There was still slavery, but it was toward the end of the slavery era. Many Southern and Eastern European whites, Italians, Polish, Greek, came in around 1900 after slavery was over. But once in place, that white racial framing and white privilege, it carries over onto people who come in later as whites. Those Southern and Eastern Europeans quickly became whites. And they gained privilege because they came in the middle of the near slavery period called Jim Crow segregation. Jim Crow segregation was not just in the South. The Northern version of it we call de facto segregation, but there was almost as much racist discrimination from 1900, from 1880 to the present day in the North as in the South. So reparations, in my view, should start with the living African Americans who suffered extreme racial oppression under Jim Crow segregation. And almost all whites have been here for several generations under the white privileges that came out of the Jim Crow era from the 1880s till the 1970s. If you start with reparations for living African Americans who suffered hugely under Jim Crow segregation, most of them are now fairly elderly, but they're still alive. And they can tell you which whites lynched their brothers, which whites raped their daughters, which whites stole their land. And like I said, almost all whites, including those who came in the 1880s, 1890s, 1900s, have been here long enough to profit under the white privilege during the Jim Crow era. And of course, today we still have widespread racial discrimination favoring whites of all backgrounds in housing, employment, in the political system, in education. In my book, Racist America, I provide hundreds of studies showing current racial discrimination, which favors whites who walked off the plane yesterday from Europe, as well as those who have ancestors going back 19 or 20 generations. It's a good question.
Another question that we're getting various iterations of is what you recommend everyday people do in terms of educating themselves more about this issue, because for most people, they can't sign up and take your class, and what they can be doing to educate other people around them.
Yes, there are a couple of books at the top of the bestseller list that are quite good, and there are many more. There are also anti-racist organizations that have reading lists, have workshops and seminars. One of my favorites goes by the acronym ASDIC, ASDIC. It's Anti-Racist Study Dialogue Circles. And they do workshops, they have reading lists. You can Google them, ASDIC workshop, ASDIC website, and there are numerous other anti-racist organizations that will give you reading lists and also set up workshops, conferences for whites and everybody else who want to engage in more anti-racist behavior toward the destruction of our systemic racism. And of course, I'd blow my own horn at the end of that handout, and all of you can get the handout. At the end of it, I list recent books that I've done, some first-rate books by Seth Rockman, who is where I got the Francis Scott Key story, and some of the other sources I use there. And all of them have footnotes that list many other good books that you can use to learn about racist America.
Another question that we're getting is what people should be doing regarding the fact that white women are often given the brunt of this as being responsible for continuing things like calling the police on Black men when because they feel unsafe, and kind of how we can be addressing these stereotypes as inaccurate that Black men are dangerous.
That's an excellent question. And our racist history, that long timeline, at the very top of all our institutions, or almost all of them, for almost all of that history have been elite white men. The people who put in place the slavery system were elite white men. The people who put in place Jim Crow segregation are elite white men. The people today at the top of most of our major economic political institutions are elite white men. So clearly white men have played a crucial role in the creation of this racist system and maintaining it now over 400 plus years. But white women have been critical acolytes. They help implement this system, as we've seen in all these incidents. You know, they carry that white racial frame into action, which can end up in death or harm to Black men, women, and children. So while white women have not been at the very top of this racist system in terms of creating and maintaining it, with a few exceptions, they have been critical implementers of this racist system on an everyday basis. And they too need to be called out. You know, if you have a white female friend who makes one of those lighter weight, you might call it racist jokes or commentaries, call it out. And you can use the strategies I suggest. You know, you can show puzzlement if you're not a confrontational person. You can always use that one. Some racist friend, male or female, makes a racist comment. You can always say, "Can you please explain that comment?" Now, people who do racist stuff don't like to explain it, right? They'll get the point. That's a very good question. And unfortunately, in our studies of white children as young as 4 years old also enforce the racist system against Black children and other children of color. We did a book called The First R. One of my grad students, Debbie Van Osdale, and I did one called The First R. We watched 50 children in a multiracial daycare center, and we watched white girls enforcing racist stuff on Black and Asian and Latino children.
And how can we go about explaining these incredibly complex and nuanced things to children? At what point should we start teaching them about the concept of racism, and how do we do that in a developmentally appropriate way?
Yeah, there's plenty of material available from anti-racist groups and others that provide you with age-appropriate ways of doing that. In that book, in the study of the multiracial daycare center, my colleague reported telling her white friend about some of our data, and her white friend's two-year-old child, 2 years old, was already avoiding Black men on the street and getting scared seeing a Black man. So this racist framing, unfortunately, gets embedded by parents, by peers, other children, by the media, in the heads of our children, clearly as young as 2 years old. To your question of what do we do about it? Well, At those youngest ages, like 2 years old, it's about role modeling for your children. As they get older, that parental role modeling is also important, but they're also learning racist stuff from their friends and their friends' parents and from the media. So people who want to be anti-racist, and especially us who are white, as adults have an obligation to learn this racist history, to learn how to teach our children age appropriately about that racist history, and teach our children both what that white racist frame is, what it includes, that arrogant white center, as well as the anti-Black, anti-Latino, anti-Asian, anti-Native subframes. We need to know what those are, help children call them out, and help children develop some of these strategies I mentioned in that paragraph on interactive countering strategies. Teaching children how to call it out, again, you can almost always start at any age by showing puzzlement. And the person who's doing racist performance does not like it, will be uncomfortable if you simply say something as simple, can you please explain that comment? So we can teach our children, again, age appropriately, how to call things out, but especially how to understand this racist society. There are many excellent books for white children on learning about racism at all ages, and for Black children and learning to counter that racism. We have many wonderful books. One good thing about 2020 is we, over the last 20 years, a lot of excellent children's books have been written and published. And the first step for parents who want to get involved in this is to find these books and read them.
Another question we're getting various iterations of is, given that this system is racist, not just towards Black people or African-American people, but really all people who look different, how can we fix the system without having to prioritize one group? And if we do have to prioritize that one group, how do we determine who is the most worthy group, so to speak?
Well, that's an excellent question too, and a lot of people raise that question. Again, we've got to start teaching an honest history of the United States in regard to all oppressed groups, all discriminated against groups. You know, almost none of us who are white have had a stereotyping 101 course or a racism 101 course in our elementary, secondary, college education. It's the rare white person, and that person has to seek out those special courses, right? From kindergarten to graduate school, we need to be teaching an honest history of the racism faced by Americans of color, the sexism faced by women, the heterosexism faced by LGBT people. We don't do that, except rarely and scattered cases. We don't want to get into the what some people call the racism Olympics, right? Which group is the worst oppressed? But we need to teach an honest history about all these oppressions. And then that question will partially answer itself. I mean, it's clear that this racist system started with stealing the land of Native Americans. And then in just a few years, 12 years, bringing in African workers as slaves to work that land. I mean, there are some of these oppressions that start earlier than others. So we need an honest history of when the oppressions developed, what they were, how they compare with other kinds of oppressions, and who's responsible.
And the last question that we're going to have time for is why it's so difficult for white people to understand that these systems are racist and why it's so hard for them to feel empathy towards these oppressed people.
It's because we have been taught that white racial frame ever since we were born, and we get it drilled into our heads by friends, by relatives, by the media, until we die. That white frame is so dominant in the society that it takes weeks, months, and years to even begin to deframe and reframe it. That organization I mentioned, ASDIC, ASDIC, does these long-term workshops, especially aiming at whites, to answer that question. We whites have to be re-educated. We have to deframe that white racist framing of people of color. We have to deal with the white center of that white frame, a white center that says, well, white folks are the most virtuous in terms of beauty, work ethic, democracy, history, you name it, but we're not. So we whites have a lot of unlearning to do. That's really the first step toward becoming an anti-racist activist that can rebuild this society to authentic liberty and justice for all. One great thing about this country is we do have that very strong liberty and justice for all tradition going back to the beginning, and we used it in getting rid of the British. The problem with it is we then seem to have forgotten it or made it rhetoric, and we need to practice what we preach. Liberty and justice for all. It's really that simple.
And that's all we have time for on this edition of the Healthy Planet radio program. We were just listening to Dr. Joe Fagan, expert on the topic of systemic racial and gender prejudice and discriminatory behavior, and author of over 70 books on these topics. I'll repeat that the reason for pointing out the rather racist history of the U.S. is not to suggest that we're not a great country with great people, but to point out that the majority of our history is indeed littered with undeniable racism, and that we have only been the land of the free, in effect, for about the last 50 years. Once you get that, you can understand why we need to be very cautious moving forward and not take the freedom of historically oppressed groups for granted. Racism, like so many other traits, good and bad, is often passed along from generation to generation. Many have become aware of its existence and done their best to raise their kids with a mind towards justice and equality. But let's face it, there are a whole lot of families that have passed along that horrible trait. Things like this can take generations to snuff out. The process has to start here and with us. We need to speak out against oppression in our lives with our votes and with our words. And with the diminishment of oppression will come the rise of a cleaner environment, since with racism comes the potential for not paying attention to the health and well-being of those who have been historically and are still oppressed and disproportionately suffering from hazardous substances in our air, water, and food. This is Bob DiBenedetto on The Healthy Planet on WUSB 90.1 FM, Stony Brook, New York. I'll be with you again on Friday, July 2nd at this same time. That's right, Friday at 6 p.m. And when I'm not here, be sure to listen to Natural Alternatives and The Healthy Planet shows every week at this time, with great hosts like Beth Fitteni and Dr. Eugene Zamperone month after month sharing cutting-edge health and environmental information. That's every week, Fridays at 6 p.m. For more info on Healthy Planet and our radio shows, or if you're interested in having me do a virtual presentation to your school or group, visit our website at www.healthyplanetusa.org or email us to join our mailing list at info@healthyplanetusa.org. And like our Facebook page, which is at Healthy Planet USA. Until next time, stay strong, relax, make your voice heard in this world by continuing to speak up for what's right, even if the political climate around you is challenging. Be kind to those around you, including our amazing four-legged friends, and enjoy this beautiful world that we all share.
Our climate is changing. Making a few changes to your driving habits can cut tailpipe emissions and improve fuel efficiency. Drive smart. Go easy on the brakes and gas pedal. Get regular tune-ups by following your vehicle's maintenance schedule. Check your tire pressure. Combine as many activities and errands into one trip as possible. Reduce your carbon impact to the environment. Act now on climate change.
A stay in the hospital for people of all ages can be a stressful and challenging experience. But every day, teams of volunteers in UCLA's People Animal Connection, or PAC, make the lives of patients and their families better.
You see the patients get happier and more relaxed. They kind of forget that they're in a hospital bed.
The visits are provided to hospitalized patients without cost. Learn how you can get involved at uclahealth.org/PAC.